This show is sponsored in part by Insynergy for personalized addiction care. At Insynergy, you'll find quality addiction care that is personalized and evidence-based. They have a comprehensive approach with a wide range of options. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, contact Insynergy for a same-day or next-day consultation. Call them at 314-649-STOP. That's 314-649-STOP. Or visit them at InSynergySTL.com. That's InSynergy for personalized addiction care.
This is the Medical Beat on 97.1 FM Talk.
All right. Hey, good morning, everybody. This is the Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey, and we're going to have a good day. The show today is going to be all about the mental health of school kids, the mental health of our kids, you know, especially as it relates to their experience in school. Really, nowadays, you know, more so than before, you know, with online learning and kids being separated from their friends, you know, that's got to be rough on the kids, or at least weird. So we're going to talk about that. You know, what is this? What are these recent times like for the kids? What's it been like for the teachers? And what is it that we can do to try to create a healthy learning environment for the kids so that they can have, you know, the best experience and the best education that we can give them in school? And, you know, as far as education and mental health, today we have the perfect guest to talk about this. We have Dr. Brian Perlman. Dr. Perlman is a former school teacher, a former school principal. He works as an educational consultant and speaker, and he's also a therapist. So in his spare time, and I chuckle at the term spare time. How does he have any spare time? In his spare time, he writes really good books. He recently published a book, which is moving up in the ratings on Amazon. And the book is called Maslow Before Bloom. And we're going to talk about that. So hello, Dr. Perlman. How are you doing?
Dr. Harvey, I am doing great. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm really, really glad to have you on the show today. This is great. Yeah, glad to have you here. So, hey, we want to kind of start by talking about your book. Now, I got to admit, the title of the book is Maslow Before Bloom, and I knew who Maslow was. I didn't know who Bloom was. I had to Google that one. Can you, for the sake of the audience, can you explain who is Maslow, who is Bloom, and what does the title of your book mean to educators?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, if you did a Google search on Bloom, you could have found like 400 or 500 different people. But the significance yeah. of Maslow before Bloom is the notion that Abraham Maslow was a psychologist for a long time, since deceased, as is Benjamin Bloom is the other part of that title. He's more of an educational psychologist. And the significance you'll see on social media, particularly Twitter, using that Maslow before Bloom is kind of one of those hashtags that educators use. And really kind of boiling that down is this notion in education or working with kids that we have to focus on the basic human needs first, and then we can get to academics. And really what that means is if there's a student that has a significant mental health concern, we need to kind of help and address that. If it's anxiety, if it's depression, if it's any number of things, if it's trauma related, that the more that we can do to help that student in that area, the more successful they're going to be in the academic piece. When we see students, particularly those with behavior concerns or those that are not performing, we know that, you know, now we know. Back in the day, we didn't really know what was going on. Kind of blame the kid or blame the behavior. But really what the focus now is to really figure out what the underlying cause is. And, you know, Maslow is really famous. You know, his greatest work or one of his more significant works was this whole notion of hierarchy of needs and looking at kind of like a pyramid, working your way up as people progress through having like physiological things addressed, and then safety and love and esteem, and then finally self-actualization. And the belief is, in order to move up the pyramid, you have to have that solid foundation. That's kind of the Maslow before Bloom. Yeah. And with Bloom, he was well known for his taxonomy of learning. And it's actually interesting because he also has his own pyramid. And as you work your way up, it's from things simple like remembering basic facts, to understanding, to applying, to analyzing, to evaluating, and then to creating something new and exciting. So really, the title of the book is just this notion that we have to address the Maslow needs first. It's really important that we do that. In doing that as a team between educators and, you know, within the school, you know, counselors and social workers and outside resources, if we can help the students, then we can really, it's like unlimited potential for them to work their way up to their greatest achievement or academic. So that's kind of where that came from.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So two things, I guess. One thing I'm wondering, and we might need to save this topic for a different day, but I wonder why so many famous psychologists are into pyramids. You know, why pyramids? Why not a rectangle or a pentagon, or you know what I mean? Why a pyramid? But anyway, but
why not a rhombus?
We'll save
it. We could throw a rhombus.
Yeah. A rhombus.
We can tie a psychiatrist and educate a therapist together. We'll come up with our own shape.
We should do that. Yeah. I mean, why not Maslow's rhombus? You know, I don't get it. But anyway, well probably that'll be another show. But so anyway, I guess the other thing is, it sounds like what you're saying, and this totally makes sense to most of us, I think, is like if a kid is hungry all day in school, he's probably not going to be a good student. Or if a kid's being mistreated at home, or if they just have a bad problem with anxiety or depression or whatever, probably they're going to do poorly in school. So anything the school can do to help meet those needs will also help them as far as education. Is that the gist of it?
You are spot on. You have hit it the nail on the head. That the thought process is, you know, there are things that we can even be doing in the schoolhouse. Look, a teacher prep program, even programs for school administrators, there isn't a lot of depth in their learning that hit on things to do with mental health and trauma. It's getting better. I mean, I teach two courses on this at a local university, rewrote the course over the last year and a half or so, and put more of this information, more about trauma, more about behaviors into the coursework. There really isn't much that a teacher principal goes through. They'll take child or adolescent psych, and they'll take ed psych of the exceptional child. That's it. There's not a lot of prep work.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're trying to do, certainly we don't want teachers or principals to become, you know, psychologists, just, you know, practicing without a license, but having that awareness that if somebody's hungry, just like you said, feed them. If a kid hasn't slept in 3 days, you know, there's nothing wrong with letting the kid take a nap in the nurse's office, or for the younger kids, have a beanbag in the back of the room. If they're scared, you know, you can give some reassurance. You can give, if they need love, you can give them, well, pre-COVID, you could give them a hug. I don't really know. Maybe a virtual hug would be okay right now. But I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's so many things we can be doing to help meet their basic needs. So, yeah. So anyway, I think we're getting close to break time there. So when we come back, we're going to talk more about Maslow before Bloom, what we can do to help meet the kids' basic needs through the schools, and how that might help their education. And in just a little bit, we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey, and we have with us Dr. Brian Perlman, who is an expert in education and also a therapist and many other things. And he's here talking about his new book, Maslow Before Bloom. And if you missed the first part of this, I guess Maslow Before Bloom is, I guess, a phrase that people, for people who work as teachers, it's probably kind of obvious what that means. To people like me who are not teachers, it was not so obvious. But the gist of it is that it's important to meet the basic needs of kids before they can really, before it's easy for them to learn. But let's get back to Dr. Perlman here. I guess just to start with, can you kind of tell us what is it that gave you the idea or the inspiration to write Maslow Before Bloom?
You know, Dr. Harvey, that's a great question. It's kind of interesting, and we'll, I'm sure, touch later on about my first book, but I thought my first book was it. I thought that was it. It was great. We're good to go. And my wife, Dr. Lena Perlman, the therapist in town, had been encouraging me to write book number two. And as I was, you know, framing it together, it just kind of one night came to me that this notion of Maslow Before Bloom, really thinking about it, that it would be so important to spread the word to more educators who maybe aren't as familiar with this, administrators, counselors, social workers, and everybody, even outside of education, to kind of better understand that, you know, for the longest time in education, I mentioned earlier, it was kind of like blame the kid, right? The kids acting out, can't concentrate, kids, you know, belly aching about something, blame the kid, blame the house, blame society, whatever. And playing the blame game doesn't really help. I'm really all about positive outcomes and things that are effective. And it just kind of all these ideas I had and had and all these stories that, you know, I had lived through as a teacher and my own life and as an administrator really was like, if I had thought about Maslow Before Bloom way back in the day, I think outcomes would have even been that much better. But really helping people, even within our field, who don't fully appreciate that impact of, you know, the basic human needs before academics. And there are still educators out there who are more of a fixed mindset or traditional model of, well, the way I went to school was this way, and that really worked well for us, which I could argue, I don't know that it worked really well for all of us. So just having the understanding that these pieces, if they're addressed well, kids will achieve to a higher level. I tie in my stories quite a bit. At one point, I was, as a principal, I probably suspended more kids in a year than anybody did. And it was like the definition of insanity because I would keep sending kids home and somehow, some way, expecting that they were going to come back to school better. And Dr. Harvey, that literally never happened. So I really feel like a lot of the motivation is to help others learn from some of the successes that I had in this field for a long time, but also, maybe more importantly, learn from the mistakes that I made before I fully understood the impact of mental health, the impact of trauma, the role that we have to play wearing the multiple hats with the ultimate goal of helping every kid to achieve to their highest potential.
Yeah. And how does that actually play out in the school? You know, because I guess, you know, the teachers are, you know, of course, very busy teaching their subjects. What kinds of things can they do to help the kid with the Maslow needs?
You know, it all starts with, as simple as this sounds, it all starts with the relationship. It all starts with the connection. It starts with really having that high empathy, having that compassion, having that desire to get to know the kids and to help them to progress to their highest level. I am asked, you know, I travel all over the country talking to schools and districts and organizations on items very related to this. And I'll get the question of, how am I supposed to have time to do this? And I'll argue back, how do you not have the time to do this? That if you're looking for ways for kids to achieve and for the class environment to be the best that it can be, putting in the work, even the little things that you can do to tweak things, will pay off very high dividends at the end. And just it's just kind of looking for other ways. I do a problem-solving process when I'm out in schools, and it is covered in the book, where we do kind of sit down and get to know and figure out what's going on with the student, and then look for things that could be done. Some kids need extra movement, right? There's all kinds of research now that they say sitting is like worse for you than smoking. I mean, it's like got such negative health impact. So somebody who may have an attentional type of concern, building more movement breaks in during the day, let the kid get up and move. Maybe giving them more responsibility than we feel like they've earned, but building that responsibility makes someone have a more positive self-image. They're able to get out and connect with other people and building those relationships, and it's giving them hope. Because for so many of our kids, whatever that home circumstance, or maybe they're struggling in school, you find that people are lacking in hope. And big picture-wise in society, one of the top reasons or big reason why people do self-harming things or even contemplate suicide is because they're hopeless. These types of things you can just bake right into the ingredients. Just bake it into your school day. I'm not looking for people to extend the day or have to come up with a program or a binder or put in a lot more work. I don't really believe that it does any of those things. It's just really being aware, being really deliberate, and really having the mindset of this is what's best for kids. If I invest here, the outcomes are going to be better.
So a lot of these are things that the teachers or the school systems can do, you know, possibly without any extra burden. It might just be something they need to have a bigger awareness of to succeed at.
I believe so. I mean, I have plenty of things in this book and also in my first book of things that I did. I'm the type of person, Dr. Harvey, that if I don't like something or I don't like the outcomes, I'm going to try anything and everything that I can to get better outcomes. And it could be something as simple as kids misbehaving in the lunchroom or being disrespectful and presenting to them that this isn't working. I have to feed you, but I don't have to let you, you know, being in the lunchroom is a privilege. Now you guys have to come up with some way to spend your time. And having a group of boys who thought about, maybe we should knit. Well, what would you want to knit? Well, my little nephew was in the NICU, that, you know, in the hospital. And it's important now. Maybe they're running out of those hats. So maybe we could start a little boys knitting group to make those little preemie hat things, right? So the baby's heads can be worn. And just doing something like that, literally, we had a volunteer, things were donated, it cost us nothing, and the outcomes were incredible for that group of kids. I did a morning martial arts group. I had the assistance of a former USC fighter in town who joined me in that program, and then another MMA person joined and took over, and we brought a group of boys, then boys and girls together, just to build that team and that community and that we're counting on each other and that mentality that a lot of these kids don't have that available to them. So again, that little bit of out-of-the-box thinking, that little bit of creativity, the outcomes were incredible, almost 100% positive outcome for all of those kids. It's just thinking a little bit outside of the box. And again, the outcomes, the effectiveness were amazing. I mean, they were just incredible.
And it sounds like, you know, meeting a lot of those kids' more basic needs might help them, you know, do better in school, but also be better behaved, and that might make things better for the teachers. The most of my teacher friends are pretty stressed out, you know, that they've got really hard jobs. So possibly these things could make it better.
There's no doubt. And I'll just say both of my grandparents taught for like 40 years. What they taught and retired in the mid 80s, if they were alive today and walked into our schools, it wouldn't even look familiar to them. The amount of work put on teachers, the amount of needs coming in the front door, you know, this notion of, well, you get your summers off. I don't know a teacher that takes a summer off between continuing education, preparing for next year, working other jobs. You know, oh, well, it's a 9-to-5 job. I don't know where that one is. I don't know what school that is because I've never seen it. It is a very, very difficult job. It's a very high stress job. But the thing is, again, anything when I was the administrator, as I'm guiding schools now, anything we can do that can really help the kids will then help the staff. I work a lot with staff teams on self-care. I mean, educators are the worst at self-care. Perhaps of all the fields out there, they might be the worst. So for sure, that is something that I'm cognizant of. And it also is a part of the books. And it's also part of the trainings and conversations that I have.
Yeah, got to help the teachers and the kids. I guess the teachers have to help themselves, kind of like the oxygen masks coming down in the airplane or something. But hey, we're going to be back in just a little bit. We are going to continue this conversation with Dr. Brian Perlman after these messages.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right. Hey, we're back. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey. This is The Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. We've been having a great show with Dr. Brian Perlman, and we're talking about education and the mental health of kids. This is going to be a great topic for anyone who works as a teacher, or anyone who is a student, or has a kid who is a student, or whatever. If you missed the first part of this show, you can find us at themedicalbeat.com, and we have our podcast feed there, so you can listen to our podcast if you missed the first part of the show. So I think one thing I want to ask Dr. Perlman here, and this is something I can't believe I didn't bring this up earlier in the show, but I noticed that there's a pandemic going on recently, Dr. Perlman. How is that affecting? I mean, it's obviously affecting it a lot in many ways. How do you think that is affecting the kids? How's that affecting the teachers? How are schools dealing with this? What's been going on with all that?
Yeah, this is definitely one of those things that I feel like education, our field, we're very forward thinking. Teachers generally are very well prepared and they're incredible planners. And what's really interesting about this whole COVID thing is that nobody really could have predicted this or planned for it. And to see, even if it's not perfect, and you might see on social media, sometimes parents complaining or different comments on what's going on with this. Understanding that literally you changed all of education in like the flip of a switch and were able to move this to a distance learning or an online learning or some combination of that, like literally overnight and with no playbook, because nobody has the playbook for a novel virus. By definition, it's new. Nobody knew that this would be something.
Right.
And you know, not many people, certainly none working in the education field, were around for the Spanish flu. I can't imagine that any of those folks are still around. So the interesting thing is, you know, my focus is a lot on trauma, mental health, challenging behaviors, self-care, all of those things. And we know from a lot of the research out there on adverse childhood experiences, which is one of the markers for trauma, one of the ways that we say that. We knew before anyone knew what COVID was, that roughly two-thirds of us, so 66-ish percent of us, had an ACE score of at least one adverse childhood experience. So you could say two-thirds of us have some level or another of trauma history. My belief is with COVID, knowing that people are getting sick, that people are dying, that our world literally overnight for the last at least significantly 2 months has certainly not helped the folks that are already dealing with trauma, already dealing with mental health concerns like anxiety or depression, that my belief is I'm pretty sure we classify all of us now, 100% of the people having some trauma type impact. So for schools, it's not just what are we doing now? A lot of schools are ending now. Like, I have lots of friends and certainly know quite a few folks who are ending now, you know, with this virtual thing, or, you know, maybe aren't doing summer school in the conventional way, but now are really, again, forward looking to say, what's school going to look like when we come back? Not just are we in person, are we in person and online, are we solely just online, but what are we doing for the kids? Not just the kids, what are we doing for the grownups who have all faced this, just like, I mean, our whole lives have been interrupted. And what are we doing for the community? What are we doing for the families. If we already knew that the majority, or a simple majority, if you add trauma, you add mental health concerns, the majority of kids coming in, and maybe the adults as well, pre-COVID, already had concerns and issues in that domain. Now that number is such, it's almost everybody. If it isn't everybody, it's thinking about what are we doing to meet those needs? How are we, for some people, grieving the loss of 2 months, the loss of community members, the loss of, you know, the change in everything? This is one of those big yeah. things that we're all going to remember. We're going to talk about what life was like pre-COVID, what it's like right. now. And maybe when we fast forward a year or two from now, Dr. Harvey, maybe we're going to say there's some real positive things that came from this. But on the in the immediate time now, in the starting of the next school year, I mean, to meet the needs of all of the trauma and all the mental health concerns, I mean, it's just an astronomical number to think about the number of hands on deck, the amount of planning we're going to need to do so we can get to some level of some kind of normalcy and not just sweep it under the rug. If kids have feelings and have things that they want to talk through about it, we have to be equipped to have those conversations, because it's not like in the day where, you know, the bad news stories came on one of like 3 or 4 television stations or the radio and you could turn it off. Now with phones and tablets and computers and the news cycle being all the time, nobody's been insulated from this. So I think that there's we need to be prepared for.
The kids are just constantly bombarded with bad, scary news, and that's got to be rough. I guess the other thing, I don't know, I guess also, you know, a lot of kids are used to being around their friends in person, and now the kids are going through all this terrible stuff, and for the most part, they're not seeing their friends in person, or they're hardly seeing their friends in person. So that's got to be hard, too.
You're absolutely right, Dr. Harvey. The thing that we know from the mental health side, and this is for everybody, but particularly so in kids, is one of the worst things that we tell people to do when their anxiety is high, when they're depressed, when they're dealing with, you know, thoughts and traumatic type things. One of the worst things that we can do is isolate ourselves. We say that a year ago, 10 years ago, when there was no COVID, that we definitely don't want people isolated, because it just, that never goes to a good place that way. And people can be spiraling and they could be in a really bad way and not have people around them to be able to help them. So yeah, for a lot of our kids of all ages, just having, it's so critically important to have those connections, to have those conversations, to be interacting with our peers, which kind of is the opposite of what we're trying to do when you're trying to not have this virus spread further and further. So we go out for a walk, you know, my kids and I go out for a walk pretty much every day, and, you know, we'll see playgrounds with the tape around it, right? Or the fields taped off in chain link fence closed. I walk by a school on our way and it's like a ghost town then. So you're exactly right. Definitely from the therapeutic, the mental health, the overcoming trauma, we want people to be around each other. Trying to keep COVID from spreading makes that a little bit more challenging. Schools are doing online conversations. Kids are talking through phones and texting and gaming together. And I think that certainly helps, that we can still feel somewhat connected. Yeah. But let's just be honest. It doesn't replace the fact of recess time or the lunchroom or hanging out in class together. There's no way that this is a suitable substitute, but it's the best that we can be doing, I think, right now.
Right. It's not. Yeah. And they're kind of scared and lonely, and they're not allowed to hug their friends or anything, you know, or even see them in person. So that's, yeah. How about the teachers? Have you been hearing back from some of the teachers? How are they doing through all this?
You know, our therapy practice had done like 3 webinars or Q&A discussions, all to do with this topic. And the majority of folks that tuned into that were teachers or school social workers, school counselors, administrators, and even some parents. And we touched on those very things. And as we would get questions during our segments, it would be a lot of, hey, I, even though I'm an educator or I'm this is hard because I'm not used to teaching, you know, my 15-year-old how to do their math, or I'm a high school teacher. I'm not used to...
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
All right. Hey, we're back. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey. This is The Medical Beat, 97.1 FM Talk. We've been having a great show with Dr. Brian Perlman, and we're talking about education and the mental health of kids. This is going to be a great topic for anyone who works as a teacher, or anyone who is a student, or has a kid who is a student, or whatever. If you missed the first part of this show, you can find us at themedicalbeat.com, and we have our podcast feed there, so you can listen to our podcast if you missed the first part of the show. So I think one thing I want to ask Dr. Perlman here, and this is something I can't believe I didn't bring this up earlier in the show, but I noticed that there's a pandemic going on recently, Dr. Perlman. How is that affecting? I mean, it's obviously affecting it a lot in many ways. How do you think that is affecting the kids? How's that affecting the teachers? How are schools dealing with this? What's been going on with all that?
Yeah, this is definitely one of those things that I feel like education, our field, we're very forward thinking. Teachers generally are very well prepared, and they're incredible planners. And what's really interesting about this whole COVID thing is that nobody really could have predicted this or planned for it. And to see, even if it's not perfect, and you might see on social media, sometimes parents complaining or different comments on what's going on with this, understanding that literally you changed all of education in like the flip of a switch, and were able to move this to a distance learning or an online learning or some combination of that. Like literally overnight, and with no playbook, because nobody has the playbook for a novel virus. By definition, it's new. Nobody knew that this would be something.
Right.
Not many people, certainly none working in the education field, were around for the Spanish flu. I can't imagine that any of those folks are still around. So the interesting thing is, you know, my focus is a lot on trauma, mental health, challenging behaviors, self-care, all of those things. And we know from a lot of the research out there on adverse childhood experiences, which is one of the markers for trauma, one of the ways that we say that. We knew before anyone knew what COVID was, that roughly two-thirds of us, so 66-ish percent of us, had an ACE score of at least one adverse childhood experience. So you could say two-thirds of us have some level or another of trauma history. My belief is with COVID, knowing that people are getting sick, that people are dying, that our world literally overnight for the last at least significantly 2 months has certainly not helped the folks that are already dealing with trauma, already dealing with mental health concerns like anxiety or depression. That my belief is, I'm pretty sure we classify all of us now, 100% of the people having some trauma type impact. So for schools, it's not just what are we doing now. A lot of schools are ending now. Like, I have lots of friends and certainly know quite a few folks who are ending now, you know, this virtual thing, or, you know, maybe aren't doing summer school in the conventional way, but now are really, again, forward looking to say, what's school going to look like when we come back? Not just are we in person, are we in person and online, are we solely just online, but what are we doing for the kids? Not just the kids, what are we doing for the grown-ups who have all faced this, just like, I mean, our whole lives have been interrupted, and what are we doing for the community? What are we doing for the families? If we already knew that the majority, or a simple majority, if you add trauma, you add mental health concerns, the majority of kids coming in, and maybe the adults as well, pre-COVID, already had concerns and issues in that domain. Now that number is it's almost everybody. If it isn't everybody, it's thinking about what are we doing to meet those needs? How are we, for some people, grieving the loss of 2 months, the loss of community members, the loss of, you know, the change in everything? This is one of those those big things that we're all going to remember. We're going to talk about what life was like pre-COVID, what it's like now. And maybe when we fast forward a year or two from now, Dr. Harvey, maybe we're going to say there's some real positive things that came from this. But on the in the immediate time now and in the starting of the next school year, I mean, to meet the needs of all of the trauma and all the mental health concerns, I mean, it's just an astronomical number to think about the number of hands on deck, the amount of planning we're going to need to do so that so we can get to some level of some kind of normalcy and not just sweep it under the rug. If kids have feelings and have things that they want to talk through about it, we have to be equipped to have those conversations, because it's not like in the day where, you know, the bad news stories came on one of like three or four television stations or the radio and you could turn it off. Now with phones and tablets and computers and the news cycle being all the time, nobody's been insulated from this. So I think that there's we need to be prepared for.
The kids are just constantly bombarded with bad, scary news, and that's got to be rough. I guess the other thing, I don't know, I guess also, you know, a lot of kids are used to being around their friends in person, and now the kids are going through all this terrible stuff, and for the most part, they're not seeing their friends in person, or they're hardly seeing their friends in person, so that's got to be hard, too.
You're absolutely right, Dr. Harvey. The thing that we know from the mental health side, and this is for everybody, but particularly so in kids, is one of the worst things that we tell people to do when their anxiety is high, when they're depressed, when they're dealing with, you know, thoughts and traumatic type things. One of the worst things that we can do is isolate ourselves. We say that a year ago, 10 years ago, when there was no COVID, that we definitely don't want people isolated, because it just that never goes to a good place that way. And people can be spiraling and they could be in a really bad way and not have people around them to be able to help them. So, for a lot of our kids of all ages, just having it's so critically important to have those connections, to have those conversations, to be interacting with our peers, which kind of is the opposite of what we're trying to do when you're trying to not have this virus spread further and further. So we go out for a walk, you know, my kids and I go out for a walk pretty much every day. And, you know, we'll see playgrounds with the tape around it, right? Or the fields taped off and chain link fence closed. I walk by a school on our way, and it's like a ghost town then. So you're exactly right. Definitely from the therapeutic, the mental health, the overcoming trauma, we want people to be around each other. Trying to keep COVID from spreading makes that a little bit more challenging. Schools are doing online conversations. Kids are talking through phones and texting and gaming together. And I think that certainly helps, that we can still feel somewhat connected. Yeah. But let's just be honest. It doesn't replace the fact of recess time or the lunchroom or hanging out in class together. There's no way that this is a suitable substitute, but it's the best that we can be doing, I think, right now.
Right. It's not. Yeah. And they're kind of scared and lonely, and they're not allowed to hug their friends or anything, you know, or even see them in person. So that's how about the teachers? Have you been hearing back from some of the teachers? How are they doing through all this?
You know, our therapy practice had done like three webinars or Q&A discussions all to do with this topic, and the majority of folks that tuned into that were teachers or school social workers, school counselors, administrators, and even some parents. And we touched on those very things. And as we would get questions during our segments, it would be a lot of, hey, I, even though I'm an educator or I'm this is hard because I'm not used to teaching, you know, my 15-year-old how to do their math. Or I'm a high school teacher. I'm not used to being the teacher of a 6-year-old, right? Or I'm having a hard time with balance. Or parents in general, a parent who isn't even in this field, sending a note saying, you know, I'm really skilled at my profession, you know, maybe it's a doctor or a nurse or business person, attorney, whatever it is, and they're saying, I'm really struggling. I'm struggling with this home, you know, this work-home type balance. I don't know what to do for my – I love my kids. I'm looking for the silver lining in this, but, like, I'm entertaining a kid when I'm on a conference call for work. And I guess if there's any positive thing out of this, Dr. Harvey, it's that just about every one of us is dealing with the same thing, is try to have those conversations with your peers, with others. Certainly, you know, our therapy practice has never been busier than it is right now. And it's a lot
of people
reaching out saying that we're struggling. We're struggling.
Yeah.
Our family's struggling. Our relationship's struggling.
Yeah.
And that's, look, it's from a business standpoint, that's outstanding. From a human life type of thing, that's certainly not.
Yeah.
We didn't want to be busier because of COVID and because of what people are dealing with. So, yes, for the
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But, hey, we're going to, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the book, and we have some other topics, and we'll be right back.
The tragedies claim, no matter what you say, it don't take away the pain that I feel inside. I'm tired of all the lies, don't nobody know.
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
There we go. This is The Medical Beat. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey. 97.1 FM Talk. And today we've been talking to Dr. Brian Perlman, an expert in education and therapy and all sorts of other things. And we've especially been talking about his new book, Maslow Before Bloom, a book especially for people who are interested in education. And can you tell us, Dr. Perlman, how do people get their hands on a copy of this valuable commodity?
Well, the valuable commodity, Dr. Harvey, can be purchased exclusively at this point on Amazon.com. It's Maslow Before Bloom, Basic Human Needs Before Academics, and it actually was released, I believe, on May 2nd, so it still has that new car smell about it, but definitely going on to Amazon would be the best spot to get that, and I'd love for people to read it and provide feedback, and my contact info is in there. I'd love to hear from them.
Excellent. Amazon. I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of that. So Amazon. Okay. So that's Amazon, Maslow Before Bloom. So, hey, thank you so much for being here to talk to us about this. And we're going to keep Dr. Perlman on the line here while we talk about some other things. So we're going to switch gears now. And we're actually going to pick up on a previous conversation that we had in a previous show where we talked a little bit about Zoe D. Katz. Dr. Zoe D. Katz, actually. And for those of you who missed the previous show, Dr. Zoe D. Katz is a licensed hypnotherapist with all sorts of impressive-looking credentials and all sorts of impressive-looking initials after her name. But the catch, of course, is that, and you know what the catch is, right, Dr. Perlman? Tell us what the catch is.
Well, I am thinking that the catch may be that Dr. Zoe D. Katz is not a human being after all.
That is correct. Yes, yes, you are correct. Zoe D. Katz is German for Zoe the cat. So Zoe is actually a cat, and the story behind this is that Zoe's owner, Dr. Steve Eichel, and Dr. Eichel is a perfectly legitimate psychologist, was tired of, you know, seeing all these people with, you know, kind of purchasing these credentials and making themselves look like they had a lot of expertise that they didn't actually have. So he managed to get his cat all these impressive sounding credentials. And so the extension here is it turns out that there are a lot of other examples of non-human animals with impressive certifications. Case in point, Sassafras, a poodle belonging to a physician in New York City, got a diploma from the American Association of Nutrition and Dietary Consultants. And George, who is a cat, was certified with the Board of Neuro-Linguistic Programming and also some hypnotherapy associations. And the last example here is Ollie, Ollie is a dog living with his owner in Australia, and he became the associate editor of a journal, of kind of a bogus journal, I'm sure, and many, many more examples. So there's just all sorts of examples of animals getting these kind of certifications. So I'm going to ask you, Dr. Perlman, the same question I asked the other doctors. Do you have any feelings or opinions about animals acting as therapists?
Well, yeah.
Caught you off guard.
That one? I don't know. I'm kind of like my first book was Whatever It Takes, so yeah. I'll go with that one. Whatever it takes, hey, if it's effective and people are happy in whatever way, shape, or form, kudos to them. That's great. They're very overachieving animals right there.
I guess so, yeah. And I guess my thinking is that I would think, I mean, don't you think a dog would be a better therapist than a cat?
I am not a cat fan, so I would 100% agree with you that definitely a dog would be better as a therapist or hypnotherapist or spiritual advisor, whatever the need might be.
I think so too. I'm kind of a cat person, but I do think dogs are a lot more empathetic. So yeah, so there's a lot more we could say about that, but we'll just stop there. But hey, now we're going to talk about one other thing. So we're going to ask Chad to play the thing here. Go ahead and play the thing, Chad.
And now for a moment of science.
Science. Science. Yes, science. All right. So we're in the home stretch here, just one or two more minutes of show left, but there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is that there are some recent research that was done at the prestigious Carnegie Mellon University, analyzed Twitter content related to coronavirus. So, you know, so what they were looking at is people who were sending tweets related to coronavirus, and what they were looking at specifically is that they had some algorithm where they were able to do a pretty good job of determining which of these tweets were from actual people and which of these tweets were being sent out by bots, which ones of these were fake tweets. And after doing their analysis of 200 million tweets over a several week period, they determined, now that this is going to blow your mind, they determined that 45% of those tweets were sent out by bots. Does that blow your mind, Dr. Perlman?
You know, that completely blows my mind. I wonder if maybe 25% of the tweets came from Zoe D. Katz.
That could be. Zoe D. Katz might have some opinions about that. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. Yeah, but that would probably be an authentic account, actually. But yeah, that could be. And then, I guess the other thing to take into account here is that, you know, so 45% of the internet traffic on Twitter is from bots. The other 55% are being influenced by the bogus 45%. You know, I think the 45% is steering the direction of the conversation and stirring things up. So I think it kind of messes up the other 55% also. So that's scary. And I guess also they've determined that it looks like a large coordinated effort that's probably not the work of an individual, not the work of a corporation, but almost certainly the work of a government. A foreign government, and I'll let you fill in the blanks which government that might be. Yeah, so I'll let you fill in the blanks what that might be. But anyway, we got to go out now. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and thank you for being here, Dr. Perlman. And we'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Medical Beat. Then when you graduate, you take a look around and you say, hey, wait!
You're listening to The Medical Beat.
There we go. This is The Medical Beat. I'm your host, Dr. Steve Harvey, 97.1 FM Talk. And today we've been talking to Dr. Brian Perlman, an expert in education and therapy and all sorts of other things. And we've especially been talking about his new book, Maslow Before Bloom, a book especially for people who are interested in education. And can you tell us, Dr. Perlman, how do people get their hands on a copy of this valuable commodity?
Well, the valuable commodity, Dr. Harvey, can be purchased exclusively at this point on Amazon.com. It's Maslow Before Bloom, Basic Human Needs Before Academics, and it actually was released, I believe, on May 2nd, so it still has that new car smell about it, but definitely going on to Amazon would be the best spot to get that, and I'd love for people to read it and provide feedback, and my contact info is in there. I'd love to hear from them.
Excellent. Amazon. I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of that. So Amazon. Okay. So that's Amazon, Maslow Before Bloom. So, hey, thank you so much for being here to talk to us about this. And we're going to keep Dr. Perlman on the line here while we talk about some other things. So we're going to switch gears now. And we're actually going to pick up on a previous conversation that we had in a previous show where we talked a little bit about Zoe D. Katz. Dr. Zoe D. Katz, actually. And for those of you who missed the previous show, Dr. Zoe D. Katz is a licensed hypnotherapist with all sorts of impressive-looking credentials and all sorts of impressive-looking initials after her name. But the catch, of course, is that, and you know what the catch is, right, Dr. Perlman? Tell us what the catch is.
Well, I am thinking that the catch may be that Dr. Zoe D. Katz is not a human being after all.
That is correct. Yes, yes, you are correct. Zoe, and actually Zoe D. Katz is German for Zoe the cat. So Zoe is actually a cat, and the story behind this is that Zoe's owner, Dr. Steve Eichel, and Dr. Eichel is a perfectly legitimate psychologist, was tired of, you know, seeing all these people with, you know, kind of purchasing these credentials and making themselves look like they had a lot of expertise that they didn't actually have. So he managed to get his cat all these impressive sounding credentials. And so the extension here is it turns out that there are a lot of other examples of non-human animals with impressive certifications. Case in point, Sassafras, a poodle belonging to a physician in New York City, got a diploma from the American Association of Nutrition and Dietary Consultants. And George, who is a cat, was certified with the Board of Neurolinguistic Programming and also some hypnotherapy associations. And the last example here is Ollie. Ollie is a dog living with his owner in Australia, and he became the associate editor of a journal, of kind of a bogus journal, I'm sure, and many, many more examples. So there's just all sorts of examples of animals getting these kind of certifications. So I'm going to ask you, Dr. Perlman, the same question I asked the other doctors. Do you have any feelings or opinions about animals acting as therapists?
Well, I don't really know
caught you off guard.
That one, I don't know. I'm kind of like my first book was Whatever It Takes, so yeah. I'll go with that one. Whatever it takes, hey, if it's effective and people are happy in whatever way, shape, or form, kudos to them. That's great. They're very overachieving animals, right there.
I guess so. Yeah. And I guess my thinking is that I would think, I mean, don't you think a dog would be a better therapist than a cat?
I am not a cat fan, so I would 100% agree with you that definitely a dog would be better as a therapist or hypnotherapist or spiritual advisor, whatever the need might be.
I think so too. I'm kind of a cat person, but I do think dogs are a lot more empathetic. So yeah, so there's a lot more we could say about that, but we'll just stop there. But hey, now we're going to talk about one other thing. So we're going to ask Chad to play the thing here. Go ahead and play the thing, Chad.
And now for a moment of science.
Science. Yes, science. All right. So we're in the home stretch here, just one or two more minutes of show left, but there's one other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is that there are some recent research that was done at the prestigious Carnegie Mellon University, analyzed Twitter content related to coronavirus. So, you know, so what they were looking at is people who were sending tweets related to coronavirus. And what they were looking at specifically is that they had some algorithm where they were able to do a pretty good job of determining which of these tweets were from actual people and which of these tweets were being sent out by bots, which ones of these were fake tweets. And after doing their analysis of 200 million tweets over a several week period, they determined, now that this is going to blow your mind, they determined that 45% of those tweets were sent out by bots. Does that blow your mind, Dr. Perlman?
You know, that completely blows my mind. I wonder if maybe 25% of the tweets came from Zoe DeCats.
That could be. Yeah, Zoe DeCats might have some opinions about that. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. Yeah, but that would probably be an authentic account, actually. But that could be. And then, I guess the other thing to take into account here is that, you know, so 45% of the internet traffic on Twitter is from bots. The other 55%. Are being influenced by the bogus 45%. You know, I think the 45% is steering the direction of the conversation and stirring things up. So I think it kind of messes up the other 55% also. So that's scary. And I guess also they've determined that it looks like a large coordinated effort that's probably not the work of an individual, not the work of a corporation, but almost certainly the work of a government. A foreign government, and I'll let you fill in the blanks which government that might be. Yeah, so I'll let you fill in the blanks what that might be. But anyway, we got to go out now. Thank you so much for listening to the show, and thank you for being here, Dr. Perlman. And we'll be back next week. You've been listening to The Medical Beat.